I was not rebelling against the system. I wasn't like, I'm not going to shave my armpits or wear deodorant. I was like, I'm going to play the system the best I can, working with what I've got.
From PRX, it's How to Be Amazing. I'm Michael Ian Black. GQ magazine called my guest today, quote, the biggest potty mouth in America. And it's true that the comedian Amy Schumer is fearlessly filthy. But beneath the sex jokes is a fierce intelligence and confidence that has had her delivering speeches on female empowerment and refusing to be airstooped by Jerry Lewis. Her hit television show, Inside Amy Schumer, is a sketch comedy show that deals with issues of gender, race, and yes, dick jokes. Full disclosure, I have appeared twice on Inside Amy Schumer, and I was great. I first met Amy Schumer several years ago when I hosted a fake reality show on which she was a fake contestant. Since then, Amy's star has taken off and my career has gone down the toilet. Amy Schumer, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start today with being almost mounted by Jerry Lewis. How did that happen?
Who doesn't? I was doing a roast at the Friars Club of Jack Black. Have you ever done one of those?
I'm not invited to do things.
Okay, cool. That sounds way better. But they told me it was an honor, which means you're not getting paid.
Right.
And
this is an honor for you to be here today, right?
Excuse me?
This is a real honor for you to be here today.
Bye. Can I just like take one of these lamps? So and Jerry Lewis was on the roast, and there were two other women on the dais, and the first one went, and after her set, Jerry Lewis got out of his seat and pretended to fuck her, and everyone laughed, and she laughed, and then he sat back down, and then Sarah Silverman did a set, great set, and she killed, and then Jerry Lewis got out of his seat, and he pretended to, like, bend her over, or, like, he pretended to fuck her. And she's like, okay, and like everyone laughed. And I didn't even think about it because I don't think of myself as
desirable.
Right, as someone who like is deserving of sexual attention. So
of an octogenarian's mounting.
Right, I just was not prepared to be mounted. So I finished my set. I was really proud of it and took my little notes and went to walk back to my seat. And then I see Jerry Lewis coming toward me and I thought, oh my God, he's going to pretend to fuck me. And he came up at me and he pretended and he like pushed me, and there was like a stage in the back of the stage, like I was supposed to lay down on the stage and he was going to pretend to fuck me. And in the moment decision, I wouldn't do it. And he was like, and he's whispering in my ear, lay down. And I went, no. And I like just used my cord and stayed up. And he's strong, but I was stronger. And I stayed up and he gave up and went and sat down. And then when it was his turn to do a set, he spent some of the time talking about how Sarah and I were too filthy and we like don't have really a right to be there. But yeah, I was like, no, Jerry Lewis, I'm not going to let you pretend to fuck me. And it wasn't something I decided beforehand. But in the moment, yeah, I was just like, I felt like that's such a way to take the power away from the person who just did a great job as a comic. And I was like, that's so, what a calculated, gross thing to do.
My daughter did a similar thing, not with Jerry Lewis. She had picture day the other day at school.
Okay.
And for weeks before picture day, she's been talking about making a funny face during picture day. She wants to make a funny face during picture day, knowing that they weren't going to let her make a funny face. She's like, Mom, can you write a note saying that I can make a funny face during picture day? And my wife said, sure. And I guess she didn't write the note, whatever it was. But they wouldn't let her make the funny face. So she was upset about that.
And not even one? Like, she wasn't like, look, I'll give you some, just give me my take?
No, and she was, I guess she finally succumbed. And then they wanted her to pose, like, in a full body pose. And then, like, put your hand on your hip, like so. Like what? Like she's at a television premiere or something.
Yeah.
And she said, no, thank you. And I was very proud of her.
I love that. That is a very early lesson that I
know.
That's really cool.
So
I think that's really cool.
I thought it was cool too. And, you try to think as a parent of a daughter in particular, but as a son too, that you're raising feminist children.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how early in your life you thought about issues of gender and sexual politics and all of that?
I think really early, because I was funny and I understood
and
early on. I saw the wheels turning on you. I was like, this asshole. But it was like real early on. It was I was funny and it was just, it kind of made clear to me in like elementary school that being funny was for the boys. And I'm not a tomboy. I feel very much like a woman, but in middle school, I loved the Jerky Boys and just wanted to make prank phone calls and wanted to watch SNL. And I loved Gilda. And I like was drawn to all things funny, and none of my other girlfriends were into that at all. And I found boys that liked that stuff, and we were close. But the general consensus, it really was like, just be quiet and like try and be pretty, mm-hmm. and everyone's supposed to like you.
And were you seeing positive affirmation from your male friends who were funny, and you felt like you weren't getting that same affirmation?
Yeah, in general, I wasn't getting that same affirmation. It was, but
is
I was
it possible,
like,
you just weren't as funny as they are?
No, I was super funny, and also it became clear that a woman's value was gonna be heavily placed on how good looking you were real early on. And
so
yeah,
was there a conscious decision on your part to rebel against that? Did you feel like you were consciously doing that?
Rebel against?
Against that idea of my worth is going to be determined by my looks and not by anything else, my sense of humor, my intelligence.
Well, something that I realized just kind of naturally, but I just watched a Gloria Steinem interview where she talked about getting burnout. Like, you just want too much action and too much change at once, and it doesn't work that way. You need to just kind of chip away at it and do what you can in your time. And I was not rebelling against the system. I wasn't like, I'm not going to shave my armpits or wear deodorant. I was like, I'm going to play the system the best I can, working with what I've got. And I remember kind of having that thought early on, and but with stand up, I was just trying to get laughs, mm-hmm. and but also being aware of the package that I come in. And then I did like try and work the system and use it as a woman, so that my voice would be heard.
And how long?
You know, but you know what I mean by that, right? Like, I guess it's you're trying to communicate or just get laughs or whatever, but that people get annoyed hearing women talk too long. They're just, at a certain point, men and women, they're just like, I really think that's true of most people. So when I started stand up, I felt like I had to like kind of trick them into listening for longer than they would usually.
Well, how would you do that?
I would wear a shorter skirt and mix in jokes that I wasn't that proud of. Or just say like attention grabbing things where I would really have to sneak in what the real punchline was, mm-hmm. As like an afterthought.
So let's listen to a little bit of your stand up. Here's a clip from your first original 1 hour stand up called Mostly Sex Stuff.
I went on a date with a guy recently and he was like really hot. So I was pretending to be a good person, you know? I was saying things like, I love kids and I'm not racist. just vague lies. And you have to like pretend like you want to use a condom. I like to say something fun when I bring it up, but honest, I'll be like, you're gonna want to wear this. I've had a busy month. It's like a petri dish right now. I don't know what's happening.
Oh. Good times, right?
So great. Really holds up.
You've been described a lot as being, this is a new term for me, sex positive.
Oh.
Do you know that term?
Does that mean I have AIDS?
I don't think so. I think it just means you're pregnant.
Oh, great. Can't wait.
Sex positive, I guess, is sort of a label affixed to women who speak about sex unabashedly or sort of unashamedly. And sex does play a big role in your stand-up. And I guess I wonder why. Is it because, you know, sex is just sort of funny and people relate to it easily? Or is it really something that you spend a lot of time thinking about and or doing?
It's, I'm a sexual girl. I have always felt that way. And I don't know how other people feel, but I do think about sex and love a good amount. But I think everyone, I kind of think everyone's like that. And they just, but it's like we're not allowed to really.
Well, maybe, do you feel like women aren't allowed to sort of admit to their own sexuality even now?
Well, definitely, because if anyone really listens to my stand-up, it's like, and I'll make jokes like, you know, I play up how promiscuous I am. And I've had phases where I have definitely like spread myself thin and
rephrase that.
Spread my legs wide.
Okay, thank you. Better.
You know, it's like I'll date somebody for a couple years and then I'll be single for a couple months and I'll be in a bunch of pain about the breakup and I'll be like, I just need to sleep with someone. And then I'll like go out and I'll like make out with somebody and then stop before we have sex. Or maybe I'll start dating somebody else and maybe I will sleep with someone in between relationships. And in talking to my friends and, you know, the biggest laughs that come from just within my friends and with my sister, or whatever. Like yesterday, I had eaten so much popcorn before I fell asleep that I almost like split my lip. I could like feel like the sodium got to my lip, and my face was so swollen in the morning that, and I was icing it with a chicken fajita, like a frozen fajita, and I was while I was eating a cookie, and I sent a picture of myself doing this to my like best friends, and it just makes you feel less alone. And we all laugh, or I'll call and I'll be like, I like slept with this guy and it was a nightmare. And it's like this painful, like embarrassing thing that you feel better about when you talk to your friends about it and less alone. And then they admit something. And I like operating in that kind of, in that space. And I think that's the funniest stuff. And I'm more interested in talking about sex and hearing about people's sex lives and their like gross behavior that they're embarrassed about than anything else. But you know, then it's like, oh, okay, so now I'm the sex comic. And that can be really misunderstood because the things that I'm saying, you know, I'll make a joke about sounding more promiscuous than I am. And I just feel like I think we should be able to just talk about it. And I don't like that because I talk about sex that I would be labeled in someone's mind as just like, oh, this girl's so easy. Like I'm usually in a relationship. I'm just talking about sex, and girls shouldn't feel dirty or ashamed because.
And do you feel like there's a double standard in comedy with comics talking about sex?
Yeah, I think Jim Norton or Attell wouldn't be labeled as like the sex guys. And I think that they talk about it just as much, if not more than me. But I did name my special mostly sex stuff because that's what it was about. And then calling my show Inside Amy Schumer. That's like a marketing decision.
The last tour is called the Backdoor Tour, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Well, that's me like, you know, it's like, all right, let's market it how we're going to market it. But then, you know, it's like at a certain point, it's like, oh, here she comes again, like more whatever jokes. But I don't know. It's like that stuff is still what makes me laugh and interests me. But I do think I'm saying something. It's not just at this point, it's not just like my pussy's dirty joke.
So, but you didn't intend to be a stand-up initially, right? I mean, you came to New York to be an actress.
Well, I'm from New York, but I just acted since I was a little girl, and I wanted to perform. I never wanted to be a stand-up even after I started. It just kind of happened that I wanted to try it, and then it just, yeah, I was always just doing plays and stuff.
So what was that moment where you're like, yeah, I think I'll try stand-up?
I went to college in Baltimore and studied theater there, and then was just like waiting tables, and I tried improv. I did like this, it was from an ad in Backstage. It was just like a way that this guy could make $50 off of a kid a month. We would have to like pay to perform. It was just, he's like, oh, and we need your dues. And we're like, what?
Your dues.
You're like, what? We meet in Washington.
Most teachers just call it tuition.
Yeah. We meet at the fountain in Washington Square Park. Like, what are we? So then.
Oh, God.
It was horrible. So I did this improv group and we had a couple shows. And one of the women in it did stand up. And I went to see her perform at Gotham Comedy Club. And then I was like, oh, I love stand up. I should try it. And then I did it like 2 days later. They were just like, if you bring four people, you can perform. And it was my birthday. And so people were like, what are we doing? And I was like, you have to come see me do stand up if you want to hang on my birthday. And I did a bringer at Gotham and I have a video of it. And it's the most disgusting display of humanity.
Where did you get jokes?
I wrote a set that day. I wrote it out. I was like, what do I? And I just, I was probably doing like a definitely Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. What's with this?
Do you remember any of that material?
I do.
Okay, let's hear it. Yeah, let's hear it.
Okay. One of the things was talking about, you know what's so sad? Like when people are like, what are those early jokes? You're still kind of trying to sell it. You know, like there is a part of me that still wants to be like,
right.
Eh?
This is going
to
kill.
But it's, I just want to say, I know it's not funny. And I'm saying this to myself. It was talking about when you're on the crosstown bus,
sure.
When you're on a bus in New York, that it's, you know, that something bad's about to happen when they have to like lower the bus. Don't encourage me. And then just like somebody in describing people that get on in those situations.
Right.
And then skywriting. I was ranting. I tried my hand at ranting about uh-huh. skywriting and how it fades and it's stupid. I mean, like I was, you know, a 21-year-old infuriated by skywriting.
Yeah.
And
what was your take
was
on the
bad.
Telegraph machine?
That's coming up. Yeah, it was bad, but the crowd was, it was better than the other bad people.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it, and I was like encouraged to come back so that I could make them more money. And then I just did it like once a month. I would do a bringer, and it was like I would rehearse my set in my head like a monologue and do it, and people were like just encouraging, like you should keep doing this.
I know your parents divorced when you were young, and were they encouraging separately and or together about your desire to be an actress?
Yeah, I feel really spoiled about it because people ask that a lot. Just so like your parents were humiliated by you, right? Then you're like, no, they were always really into it. I had a really strange experience where they made me feel like I was the absolute shit. That's why hearing your daughter's picture day story, I'm like, oh, because I just think of it like I was so encouraged at home, and then the like having my ass handed to me, like you're not that great and like you're not that great looking, was like that came from the outside world, you know, that I was like, what? Talk to my mom about that. Like, I am an angel. I grew up with like black chick confidence. Like, I was like, huh? Like, I just thought I was so awesome. And then like only when I turned 30 was I like, oh, my parents are like mentally ill. And it was backwards because, you know, you hear stories about people's parents being really hard on them, whatever.
Well, but you also hear stories, I mean, I guess more anecdotally and in the media these days, about parents who encourage their kids to a fault and then they get into the real world and they feel entitled. Did you have that experience where you felt like, well, the world needs to love me, deserves to love me? I mean, look at me.
I didn't feel entitled to that. I did kind of just always know that I'm gonna be working as a performer. I just never was like, ugh, I need another plan. I just knew that I was gonna do that, and I didn't know if that was gonna be like I was gonna be like like somebody painted gold in New Orleans on the street or what. But I didn't think I was better than other people, but I thought I was just totally fine, and that I really. When I see those, do you ever see that little girl, Sophia Grace? She's on yeah. Ellen a lot. When I look at her, I really relate to her in that she's like, I like doing this thing and everybody loves her. And you're like, oh, no one has hurt her yet. No one has like said anything that's going to crush her yet or make her question herself. And you're like, how can we keep this girl feeling this way? Is there any way to protect her from this? And there isn't. But I try to tap into when I had that kind of confidence. And
did you ever lose that confidence?
It was definitely shaken. I never lost it. It's always in there. Like I'm like, yeah, I feel, I mean, I can be in the room with some of the most, I can be at a table with like the funniest people.
Thank you.
And or here, or smart people. And I don't feel like they're any better than me, and I don't feel any better than them, just like with an open mic or Louie or whoever, you know. But yeah, I mean, I've had my confidence trampled on many, many times, but I always kind of find my way back to thinking I'm okay.
It's funny because it's the opposite story of what you hear from almost every other comedian.
That their parents, yeah.
Well, not even about their parents, although that, but yeah. But just that kind of unshakable confidence that I feel like no other comedian that I've spoken to has.
Right. I don't think I'm like the fun. I think I'm 10 years in and that I will like really be great at 20, 25 years in. But I think that's okay. I've just never felt apologetic about where I am currently.
But it seems like you've had a very, I wouldn't say easy, but a very kind of natural and relatively quick progression in your career. You went from doing these shows where you would bring people, and then you said doors just started opening.
Yeah.
And then it was probably what, the Charlie Sheen roast that really kind of broke things open for you?
Well, I did Last Comic Standing.
Oh, right. That was before that?
That was before that. My first thing ever was a just little special for Comedy Central, the Live at Gotham. And I did like a 10-minute set. And I just was like, this is the greatest thing that anyone's ever done ever. Like, I was just so excited. I couldn't believe I was doing it. And then Last Comic Standing came like 2 days later. And I was like, oh my God, there's going to be 900 people in the crowd. And they were like, 9 million people are going to watch this. Right. And I was like, what? Like, I just had no idea.
Well, you can't conceive of what that means, really.
No.
And did that change your life? I mean, was that when you started getting recognized and all of that?
That made me a headliner for a year.
Mm-hmm.
I went out, I made a bunch of money and went on a tour with them. I went on a 45-city tour. On a tour bus with four other comics. I mean, they had all been doing it about 20 years and were like hardened road comics. And then me. They were really sweet, though. They were like brothers. And they were, I must have been so annoying to them that
I'm
I was.
Sure you weren't.
But I was excited.
They were probably like, look at this, you know, fresh faced thing reminding us of what we were like.
And I was bombing. And people
really?
Love. Yeah. I was.
Well, tell me about that because you. I've never seen you bomb.
Thank you.
And you talk about this confidence that you have. Mm-hmm. So when you do bomb and you're bombing consistently.
In 3,000 seat theaters.
I mean,
everyone else is crushing.
How do you scrape yourself up off of that?
Well, I got really strong on that tour because by the end, at first, it just hurt. It was humiliating. I didn't have the experience to do well. I didn't have the confidence. There's whatever confidence you have on your own, there's nothing that can translate to working and being on the road and the hours you've clocked as a stand-up. So I could put together these little 90-second sound bites or 3-minute sets for Last Comic to do well, but when it was time to do 25 minutes, I was far from being. So I would go up, I would bomb.
Was it the material?
It was, no, because I think those jokes are actually not that bad. It was that I...
Did you do the thing about the bus lowering?
That was my closer. I was like, okay, we're in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And I just did a joke about where I alluded to that, I think, all gay people have AIDS. And and then I would, you know, rather than like... Now, if I had a joke like that... I would say that joke. And then while people were going, I would say something far worse.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would say that joke and then like kind of look out like, huh? And, you know, I wasn't the authority. I was like, do you guys, oh, no, that, not that one. Okay, well, what about this? So I was just tap dancing and sweating and bombing, and I cared. And I would, like, cry in the bunk on my, on the tour bus. And the guys were like, oh, that's all right. They're like, we don't think stand-up's going to be your thing, but, like, you're going to. And they really meant it, and, like, in the nicest way. And then by the last, like, maybe 10 cities, I just, like, and it was like not just the bombing, but we had to do meet and greets. So after the show, after I just bombed, I had to sign out there, and it was a reality show. So people would be like, my husband voted for you, but I didn't. Like, just, you know, they were like, we didn't vote for you. And you're like, mm-hmm. That also made me like want to withdraw from the world. And
I can't
just
imagine
people
why.
People would say the most hurtful shit to me. And it, you know, just night after night. And then, I just couldn't feel it. And I was like, oh, my worst fear has come true every night for months. So, yeah, I don't give a shit anymore. And then from not caring and just trusting my jokes more. Yeah, that I think like the winner of stand up now is the like, I don't give a shit award. It's like, wow, look how cool this person really doesn't care if we like this or not. People like really celebrate that confidence, but it only came from, you know, just having so much.
So like, so by the end of the tour, were you doing better?
Yeah. I was doing great by the end of the tour, and it made me so much stronger.
From PRX, this is How to Be Amazing. Coming up, I talk with comedian Amy Schumer about launching her hit television show, Inside Amy Schumer, and the moment that she learned that trending on Twitter isn't always a good thing. And so how did the sketch show come about? You look like you don't know.
I don't. Don't you feel like your whole life's a blur? I'm just like, the what?
there's a show you're doing now called Inside Amy Schumer.
What's happening?
It's a sketch show. You're on it.
Is it any good?
I mean, yeah, it's great.
All right.
People love it. I love it.
You're so funny. I know you don't want to hear it.
Be quiet. God.
I mean, just take a compliment. God. So
my total screen time on your show is maybe 2.5 minutes over two seasons.
The best 2.5 minutes. They were like, we're going to make a pilot with you. And I was like, okay, well, it's not going to get made. I mean, the show isn't going to go to series. So I also had a deal with CBS. And I was like, well, I think that might happen. Because I just did well on one roast. And so I was putting all my eggs in that basket. And I had done a thing for a pilot that you were in. And I saw you and Jessie Klein working together. And I thought she was really cool. And I'd met Jessie, but I liked your working relationship. And
Jessie is your head writer?
Yeah. And she's one of the EPs also. And I was like, will you write on this thing I'm doing? It's not going to get picked up. Just will you do it? We have to write one episode. She's like, okay. And then, and Dan Powell, who was the producer of Reality Bites Back, I just really liked him. And I was like, I want to work with Dan. And then Jesse one night was like, let's go get a drink, which meant like many drinks. And she was like, I think you're squandering this opportunity and you should be taking it more seriously. Because the show that I was like, okay, I'm pretty sure they want a talk show. I thought they wanted like a Chelsea Lately type thing. And I just didn't have any interest in that. And I didn't want to talk to celebrities. And I don't know. I didn't want to do that. But I was like, this is the best chance of getting picked up. And Jesse was like, even if it doesn't get picked up, you'll have this show that you are really proud of. So you can like make the show of your dreams, even just one episode. And I was like, oh shit. And then I was drunk and walked down the
crying
street called Dan Powell, and I was like, change of plan. And it was late in the game to change it, but then everybody was really cool and was like, I've had a lot of awful pain in my life. I think everybody does, but I think my list is pretty solid. But my career has been a gilded path. Like it's been good. And the show, they were like, sure. And I was like, okay, well, these are the things I feel I'm best at and that I want to do.
And what did you say those things were? Did you know yourself enough to know what those things are?
Yeah. I had a theater company, The Collective. And did you ever come to one of those meetings on Monday night to like work out a scene?
Is this a joke?
No, no. We, a bunch of people I studied with at the Esper Studio, we started this theater company. And every Monday we meet and people bring in what they're working on.
I thought maybe you were kidding because that sounds like such a weird actory New York thing.
I'm a secret, gross, like New York loser actor.
We work out our scenes and
it's
we get
true.
Together, we critique each other.
We do. We get feedback, but... Yeah, and I would produce a monthly stand-up show, which you did once with The Collective. And at the beginning of the night, we would put up a scene that I wrote and directed. And I'd never written a sketch before or anything like that, but I would do like these scenes. And it was really fun. And I've done a lot of Man on the Street stuff over the years. And then the talking to someone, I interview somebody at the end of the show. And just like a normal person who has like a job or something that I have never... talk to anyone that they'd do that. And I was like, I think these things. And they were like, okay. And then that's still what the show is.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good that the thing you said the show was going to be is the thing
yeah.
that the show turned out to be and that people liked it.
Yeah.
I've had the experience of saying what the show is going to be, doing the show exactly like I say it's going to be.
Yeah.
And then nobody likes it.
That's not true. That's completely
I've
not
had
true.
That experience many times.
No.
The show is, I think, rightly well regarded because it sort of very boldly confronts sex and race and gender ideas, and so in that way, it feels like it has a kind of agenda to it. Do you feel like that? Do you feel like it has an agenda?
I don't. I guess so. I mean. We come in and we're like, I think this is funny, you know, like in pitching things. But it's like right now I have this thought in my head that I'm kind of obsessed with. And it's how really beautiful people, how there's this like we have this fear of them. And we like and that's all I know right now. But I was just thinking about when Tom Brady left the model that he had gotten pregnant, Bridget Moynihan, his girlfriend. And we were all like, you know, everyone's like, what? He left his pregnant girlfriend? This is awful. We hate that. And then they're like, it was for Giselle. And we were all like, well, do they need anything? Like, where can we send gifts? And it's like, but that's only allowed because of how beautiful she is. It just these sort of allowances we make and we pretend like they're interesting and like it's okay. So with that, I would have the agenda of showing that to people, like in case they hadn't noticed it. Jesse and I are both very obsessed with body image and the world's like perception of an experience of women. And then a scene that I wrote this past year was about like, it was like a fake focus group with guys. They're supposed to say if it was funny or not. And it was just saying if they would want to have sex with me. And, you know, it's like, that's, that's from something very, very true and trying to sort of have a little bit of a conversation and show people something. But above all, trying to make just be funny.
Right.
And there are some scenes that are just like, what if I like fart whenever I'm scared? And we're like, yeah. You know? So there isn't an overall agenda. But Jess and I are both like, you know, we're both of the same school of like, having a message you want to say, but having people feel like they're not lectured because people can feel like, ugh, mom, like get out of here at all ages, all audiences, all whatever that can be. It's just like a trigger for somebody to hear a woman speaking, I think.
And so Inside Amy Schumer, big hit, two seasons running, you're going into your third season. And then you get a call from Judd Apatow basically going, hey, you want to make a movie?
Kind of. He heard me on Stern and wanted to just like meet. He just like likes to meet with comics and we just had a good vibe and then at the end of the meeting, just as a throwaway, he's like, "If you ever have an idea, we should kick it around." And I was like, "Well, I do have an idea," and I had thought of it like 2 days before, and I was like, "If it comes up," and I pitched the idea, and he's like, "Oh, okay, write that." And then I was like, hey, how do I write a movie? And he was like really cool. Like just, he's like, yeah, you could buy a book or I don't know. And like told me it's Sid Fields, his teacher at NYU. And so I was like writing the movie while I was like kind of looking at this book. And I wrote the first movie and it was fine. And it was like, I can write a movie. And I finished it. I just got a bunch of helpful tips. Like everyone gets to page 80, somebody told me, or 70. And you just got to push to the end or it'll just sit at page. And I was like, okay.
Was
and
that
I just
true?
Did that. Yeah, for me it was. I just, yeah, both times. I've written two and I went home and I just sat there and just like was getting like bed sores and then finished like 4 a.m. one night and just like I had a scotch and I was like, yeah. I wrote a movie. And like, I now know I can write a movie. And then he was like, okay. And he read it and was like, all right, we'll see you later. And it was like, he was like, okay, I still want to do this, but it just kind of quietly went away for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was like season one went well and was getting good reviews. And then he was like, that movie was a good idea. I was trying to write a movie that I thought Judd Apatow would want. And I think I like named the characters after his families. You know, I'm like, and then Maude enters. And he's like, relax. And then he's like, but think about the movie people want from you. Like, what's going on with you? And I was falling in love with this guy.
Thank you.
Not very much not you.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
And and I was like, I, what about this is what's going on with me? And he's like, okay, write that. It was just writing about what was going on and falling in love and sabotaging yourself and defense mechanisms.
And then you
doesn't
made
that
it.
Sound like a great movie?
Well, it does. It does because it sounds honest and that's sort of
it's honest
what people like.
Thank you.
Honesty. And then you started making it.
Yeah. Then we were like.
And then you just get a call and he's like, Judd's like, yeah, I think we're going to make this.
He was like, oh, rewrite this. And I think this and there's too much, you know, and I was reworking the script and he would be like, do this. And I would do it. Mm-hmm. I was like, if this opportunity goes away, it's not going to be because of my lack of effort. I am going to be on the ball. And then the script, we did a table read and then I thought he was going to produce it. He was like. But then we did auditions,
mm-hmm.
and in the auditions, he was directing.
It's what's so funny about that is I don't remember getting the call to participate in the table read,
right?
And I don't recall being invited to audition for it or even getting an offer.
You know what? I'm gonna say something that you said to me when I asked why I was never in Michael and Michael Have Issues, and mm-hmm. it was your name didn't come up
mm-hmm.
casting wise at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, turnaround is fair play. Writing that down. Turnaround. Is fair play. Great.
I wonder, yeah. so yeah, we just had like a do not cast list and you were the whole list, strangely. And then yeah, in the auditions he seemed like he was directing a lot and I was like,
are you directing this movie?
And I was like, are we even? I was like, I was seriously, why is
what's
he?
What's happening here?
I was like, why does he keep pretending like this movie's going to be made? Like, what's going on with him at home that he's like needs to do this to this poor girl? And then one day, it was like one of the last days of filming the second season of the show, and he called and was like, he said, I want to throw my hat in the ring to direct this movie. And I'm, consider it. And I just like burst into tears and was like fired up. And
right. You really have had a kind of gilded career.
I know. But I'm really lonely.
Oh, good.
Okay?
So that's something.
Yeah.
No on-set romances on the set of Trainwreck?
Me and Vanessa Bayer.
Good.
We went down on each other every day she was on set.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So along this gilded path, I mean, they're clear. There must have been potholes. There must have been. I mean, what was your biggest career setback? Can you even identify one?
I mean, I've bombed so like I've experienced I think more rejection than any comic.
Right.
Like just not more than any comic, but any comic experiences this to your face rejection so much, And I've been auditioning since I was 5 years old for shit and not getting it. This mm-hmm. is my first movie.
Right. But see, I think that's good for people to hear because on the one hand, yeah, you've found a path and you've walked along it and it's done really well for you. But there's this whole other path that, I mean, well, part of it was bombing. Part of it is scraping yourself up and being like, yeah, I sucked and people hate me and I'm going to keep going.
Yeah.
And part of it's going to auditions and 1,000 auditions yeah. and never getting it.
Never
getting
it.
And being like, I'm going to keep going.
But then it's also like realizing I don't want to be in these things. I don't want to be like the dummy best friend neighbor. Because you think it's going to be about money and whatever. And then you just, as you get older, you're like, it's actually about doing stuff you're proud of. So it's not just about creating
your own. For me, it's still about the money.
I know. You are the exception to that rule. Why are you wearing gold headphones, by the way?
I just thought I have a certain image to maintain.
Why is your mic iced out? But so it really is about like not just making your own path, but actually doing something that you like, want to do. So you like learn that. But the biggest career setbacks, I would say, were, well, not setbacks, but the thing that came to mind right away was I got cast in this commercial for a phone company. I don't remember which one. And it was like, it was weird because it was all models and I was at the audition. Yeah, so I was like, why am I at this audition? Like, because that's happened to me a couple times where I'm like, it's a special kind of pain to be in that waiting room. It really is. And so I got it. Like, it was, they cast 10 girls and I was one of them. And it was the premise of the commercial was we're all laying by a pool in like chairs laying out in bikinis. And we're able to be on the phone for so long. We have so many minutes that we get a tan line on our face from mm-hmm. the phone. So the camera was at one end and then like the chairs were all lined up from the camera. So it was like chair one was the closest to the camera and it went to 10 and I was in chair one. So we like start and they're like action. And they're like, hold on. I'm like, oh, Amy, can you move to the second chair? And I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. And then I move and then how? And then they're like, oh, Amy, we're going to put you in 3. We're going to get actually 3. So then, you know, 10.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was just like, I'm like literally like a cricket in the background. They just cut my like, they were just like, no, funny doesn't win.
Yeah.
So that was like just that day of, and there were all these extras because it was a big pool party and just having them keep moving and having to get up out of the chair and everyone's like, oh, like what's happening? So that was just like a humiliating day. But then I would say the Sheen roast, like helped the most, but also it was like a really dark time because I had one joke that people were furious about.
What was that joke?
It was to Steve-O and it was saying that I was sorry for the loss of his friend, mm-hmm. Ryan Dunn, and that he must have been thinking, like, it could have been me, and we were all thinking, why wasn't it? So, you know, just your run-of-the-mill roast joke about wishing that Steve-O was dead instead of his friend.
Instead of his very, very good friend, who just died.
By the way, I think I can say now, I didn't write that joke, and I didn't know that they were best friends.
Oh.
Yeah, like in retrospect, I'm like, that's fucking crazy. you know, there were two other jokes that were made that day that were the exact same formula about Geraldo, who had also just died. And but people, and then the editors, after I said it, they cut to Steve-O looking like, how could you? And people were furious. And I was getting serious, specific death threats. And I had to cancel some dates. And my relationship was breaking up. It was like a time that could have been really fun and exciting. And it was really dark.
Well, let's hear a clip from that. We've got a clip from the Charlie Sheen roast.
Do you have the moment my dad found out he had MS?
We do have that. So let's hear Amy Schumer and the Charlie Sheen roast.
Speaking of things that should already be dead, Charlie Sheen is still alive. Charlie. I'm a fan. You were amazing in Platoon. Your marriage to Denise Richards, it was kind of like her Vietnam because she was constantly afraid of being killed by Charlie. But there is no denying how famous you are. I mean, it was international news when you ruined the lives of those two girls living with you. You know, your daughters. But no, I mean, Charlie, you get a bad rap, but you're just like Bruce Willis. You know, you were big in the 80s, and now your old slot's being filled with Ashton Kutcher.
So I always wonder about those things, which I'm not invited to, because you don't know Charlie Sheen, right?
No, I met him the night before.
Right. So it's like you're going to stand up and just insult the shit out of some dude that you've never met.
Yeah.
Is that uncomfortable?
In the moment, it is such a weird and so weird and surreal. And now in retrospect, I'm like, it's really interesting because I'm not there yet. But like, you know, if people make a joke that offends people, you know, if Stephen Colbert, like if he says something that people are like, that's too much, then there's like he catches a bunch of flack for it. But if you're like a kind of no name comic, you have no stakes. All you have to do is say awful shit and make a name for yourself. And these celebrities have to like toe the line a little bit, like they have to watch themselves. So
you feel that line creeping up on you?
A little bit. I think a little bit.
Is it changing your comedy?
Probably. But there's like nothing at stake for you. You're just like, no one knows me. All I can do is like work hard and just, you know, crush these people. And you have an edge because you know these things about them and they don't know anything about you and they've never heard of you. And so it's like you meet each other and the night before. And as a comic, you're like, this is what I do every night. I'm the winner because it's these people moonlighting. And then and they're looking at you like they're scared and you're like, oh, and you feel really powerful. Like, oh, these like famous.
Oh, you don't feel bad in any way.
No.
So when somebody's looking at me and they're scared, I don't know that I ever feel powerful. I don't know that that's ever a feeling I desire to have somebody looking at me with fear.
No.
Except my kids.
No, I would.
Except my kids.
Except your children. No, it's something that
better.
I would.
They know what they're going to get.
I try to diffuse that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I'll tell people like, this is the joke that I'm saying about you. And I actually wouldn't say anything that I thought would hurt someone's feelings. The Steve-O
you
one.
You ruined your daughter's lives? You didn't feel like that was going to hurt somebody's feelings?
No. But you know what? But that's the thing. That's the misconception. Now I know more. I know better. I'm not like that. I'm not itching to do a roast but you just think these people are rich and famous and they're fine. And like, what am I going to say? I'm going home to my studio apartment and making, you know, $3,000 for doing 8 shows in Toronto. So you win. And I've learned that's not true and that they are hurt by this stuff. And but in the moment, it's I wasn't concerned, but I wouldn't say anything. Like they were like, don't make any jokes about Mike Tyson's dead kid. And you're like, yeah, like what? Like who the fuck? Like what? Thanks for telling me. Oh, that's off limits. Like you're, of course I wouldn't do that. So, but man, with the Steve-O thing, I was like, it was really surprising, that reaction, because it wasn't a big deal in the room. The other jokes got way bigger, like ooh, and but then I remember I was watching it with Anthony Jeselnik, who we were dating at the time, and we were like watching it, having like a drink, and then we saw them cut to Steve-O looking sad, and we were like, whoa. maybe stay off Twitter for a little while. I was like, why am I trending?
All right. So as we wrap up here, what's the best advice and worst advice you've ever gotten?
Best advice. I just heard Joan Rivers say this thing that I thought was really important, and it's been Chris Rock has said it to me, but in different words.
Name drop much?
She
just had lunch with Jerry Seinfeld yesterday.
I know, I really am. Look, I'm lonely. But I heard her say this in an interview on Stern. She said that every time she goes on a late night show, she like do it like it's your last shot, and I was gonna do Fallon. It was my first time paneling, just like sitting on the couch, and the and Chris Rock was like, "What are you gonna do on Fallon?" I was like, "Oh, like I'm just sitting on the couch, so I'm like talking about this vacation I went on, this like funny thing." And he just looked at me like I was disgusting. I was like, "What?" And I was like, "He's like, you're a comic. You have to kill. You gotta. It's that's gonna be the Tonight Show. You have to kill." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And then I ran around and like worked. So I think, yeah, not getting complacent and treating everything like it's your. Like it's your last shot.
Nobody gave me that advice either. I was on Letterman twice, bombed both times.
Well, that's he's so indifferent to everybody. It's impossible. And the worst advice I ever got.
Was it "We don't think stand-up is your thing"?
No, that actually was pretty good. Oh, you know, it actually, this was my mom. My mom was like, I did this show once. It was in a basement, and these people were barked in, and it was like no one spoke English, and it was a gross club. And I went up and did some time, and I just bombed so violently. I think people were just confused what I was doing up there. Mm-hmm. Like they didn't, it didn't even register as comedy to them. Like they were just, and my mom after the show was like, "I don't think you should do shows like this."
Like what?
Like that aren't like kind of cushy, like where the crowd isn't good.
Handpicked and
yeah, and yeah, she's like, "I don't think you should do shows like this. I would stop doing these shows if I were you." And I got like really mad, and I was like, "You don't know what you're talking about." Like, and I was like, "That's not true," because all those shows where I completely bombed and. And just doing the bad stuff is that feels awful is actually the stuff that you get the most from. The nights that were the worst, I think, is where I got what I got the most out of. So my mom gave me the worst advice ever.
All right. And I always end each episode with something I call the Amazing Five, Amy, where I'm going to toss out five categories. And you will give me your recommendations for the listeners in each category. I'm going to start with movies. An amazing movie that you've seen, that you love.
Jesus' Son.
That came out a while ago, yeah?
Oh, yeah, it's old. Is it supposed to be like...
No, it can be, yeah, it can be any time. Doesn't
okay.
matter.
Yeah.
Who's the star of that?
Billy Crudup.
Right, Billy Crudup.
And Samantha Morton.
I've never seen that movie.
It's my favorite.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Great one.
All
great,
right.
great start
yeah!
to the Amazing Five.
Should I just leave?
I mean, yeah, maybe. Mm. Music.
Rumors, Fleetwood Mac. I would say I would recommend this band Mr. Wives.
Mr. Wives.
Mr. Wives.
Mr. Your or Mr. like Mr. Mister?
Mr.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Wives.
All right. What kind of music is it?
I suck at describing music. It's a...
Was it rock? Let's start
yeah.
with that. All right.
Yeah.
So it's sort of rock
it's
music.
Rock. It's, yeah, it's a, I think the album's called Reflections, and it's, they're a newer band. I think they're out of Brooklyn, and I don't know. I can't stop listening to it.
Okay. Food.
Like.
Yeah. Anything that you like eating.
Spicy tuna hand rolls.
Mm-hmm.
I really like them at Blue Ribbon Sushi.
Spicy tuna rolls.
Hand book. Rolls.
Oh, hand rolls, excuse me.
Yeah.
Book.
I just read Lena Dunham's book. It's really good.
You got an advanced copy then, did you?
Yeah, I got one printed out. Well, I like threatened the life of some book agent.
Mm-hmm.
And I ripped up every page after I read it and felt like I was in on a secret.
And it's all that, is it?
It's all that. But you know what I would say is this book I really like for comics or... artist is the book The Professional.
I don't know it.
Yeah, it's about a boxer. It like follows this boxer getting ready for a fight, and I think it's unfortunately like very connected to what we do.
Well, sure. You killed him. You murdered him.
Was that five?
No, we're not done.
Oh yeah, you and it's like the lesson from that is that there's a line where it says the fight is won on the road. It's like not what happens in the ring. I was like, oh, that's good because it's about the work.
Very good. And then the last is general, miscellaneous. Anything in your life that you want to recommend, anything that you're loving, anything you find amazing.
Okay. I'm going to recommend Transcendental Meditation.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you get into TM, as we call it in the TM game?
Well, I just like hear... Do you do it?
No.
I just like you hear like Stern does, and like you hear like these people that you like think are doing great stuff. And then when I was living in LA for a couple months and writing the movie, and just like enough people brought it up, and I wanted to try it because I had been so busy, and every moment like it was just all these increments of things I had to do, and I had no energy, and this just totally changed the game for me.
And so you've continued doing it.
Yeah.
And what are the benefits?
Energy, focus, a general bettering of life, and feeling just physically and mentally better.
I keep thinking I should try it.
You should try
it. But it always seems so sort of like Kabbalah to me.
It's not. It's so easy that it's like, I mean, if you think about the people that do it, it's like not people that are gonna.
Right.
It's like the laziest.
David Lynch, Howard Stern. That's who I know. Those are the only people I know who do it.
The Beatles. It's just like, yeah. It was created. What they try to do with it is get it into schools to help kids with like behavioral problems or soldiers with PTSD. But then also like, you know, you could like the privilege can sneak in there, and that's what they like trying to get money for, to get it in schools and stuff. But it helps.
All right. I'm going to Google Transcendental Meditation and see if it's for me.
Okay.
Amy Schumer, I want to thank you for being part of this episode of How to Be Amazing. I know you. I love you.
Thank you. I love you.
And you continue to be amazing.
You're amazing.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook, and please follow us on Twitter, and check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. Today's show is mixed and edited by Kristen Clark, with music composed by Chad Crouch. I'm Michael Ian Black. Done.
Done.
Thank you.
Thank you. This was live, right?
Yeah. You should be, check your Twitter, and you should be trending again.
Oh, yeah.